Part 3. London. The Empire Strikes Back. A foggy day in London town. It had me worried. It had me down. I viewed the morning with much alarm. The British Museum had lost its charm. How long, I wondered, could this thing last? But the age of miracles, it hadn't passed. And suddenly I saw you standing there, and in foggy London town, the sun was shining everywhere. By George and Ira Gershwin. Chapter 25. The Streets of London. When Janaki and I arrived in Dover, the fog stroked us with its clammy hands like an unwelcoming Hitchcocky host. The immigration official followed suit in her attitude. "What's your purpose in coming here?" she demanded. Her dark hair was pulled into a severe knot at the nape of her neck. "I write for a magazine called Back to Godhead," I said. "Do you want to see a copy?" "Let me see." She sighed and held out her hand. She flicked through the pages in a distracted manner and looked us up and down. I glanced at Janaki's skirt and jacket. She looks presentable and conventional, I thought, and I hoped I did too. I'd combed my hair before we'd gotten off the ferry. "Are you with Scientology?"
"Who?"
"Scientology." "I don't know what that is." "Can I see proof of your funds?" she asked. We showed her a bank bag of notes, which was by now a much more seasoned traveler than either of us. She sighed again and brought down the stamp on my passport in a violent motion. Janaki handed over her passport, and without a word, the official repeated the thud of her stamp. "Next." "Can we go?" I asked, incredulous that was all there was to it. She nodded, now fixing her eye on the elderly Italian man behind us in the line. We exited the ferry terminal and peered through the gloom to find a train station. "Excuse me, could you tell me where to get a train to London?" I asked a man holding an umbrella. He pointed right. "Head that way, about 100 yards," he said. "The station is down there. You can't miss the sign." "Thanks." It was such a relief to be in a country where we could understand the language. Our 4 days in Holland had been difficult. Most people spoke some English, but we couldn't read signs or ingredient lists on packages, a very important part of being vegetarian. We caught a train and then a bus to the 3-room upstairs apartment that Chamsunder and Malati had secured during their first days in the country. It was in a South London suburb called Herne Hill. The block of flats, they told us, was owned by an Indian widow named Mrs. Coley. When our taxi pulled up, the two of them tumbled down the stairs to greet us and then help us drag our heavy suitcases up to the new home. "We're all here now," Chamsunder exclaimed. "Finally, we're here in England. Can you believe it?" "Actually, I'm so tired. I'll believe anything right now," Janaki said. "Yes, you need to rest," Jimunas said, still vaguely maternal toward her younger sister. "Why don't you have a shower, and we'll cook something for you. Then you can sleep or unpack or whatever." They showed us to a room, and Janaki went to have a shower. I heard the water flowing, but then I heard her shouting down the hall. "Hey, Malati," she called. "What's going on with the water? It's freezing." I went into the hallway to see Malati heading toward the bathroom. Janaki's head was poking out the door. "Here," Malati said, giving Janaki a fistful of change. "To get hot water, you have to put coins into that metal box thing on the floor by the tub." "Really? You're kidding," Janaki looked dubious. "I thought you just said you'd believe anything," Malati said. Over the next few days, we discussed our strategy for introducing Krishna consciousness in London. We decided that we'd begin here the same way we began in San Francisco, by finding young hippies, chanting with them, and having regular programs. People would become interested, our numbers would grow, and we'd start a temple. Simple as that. The catch was that there didn't seem to be very many unconventional people around. In fact, in the first few days I was in London, all I saw was tourists and men in suits. After spending more than 2 years in the American alternative scene, England seemed heavily controlled, conservative, and undemocratic. We did a bit of asking around and found out about a place called the Arts Lab on Drury Lane in Covent Garden. Chamsunder was told that this was the place that was the hub of the hippie movement, the main place where people into alternative living congregated. Top on our list of priorities was to visit the Arts Lab and to make some contacts with the objective of hopefully having programs there. One of the first things we decided we should do, now that we were in England, was to dress in traditional Indian Vaishnav clothing. It seemed in keeping with the Swami's suggestion to be enthusiastic and upfront about being devotees, especially because the Max Linder film story he told us involved wearing unusual clothing. We men were more nervous about the clothing proposal than the women were. We quickly realized how many Indians and Muslims there were living in London, and many of the women wore saris or burqas. Even though Jamuna, Janaki, and Malati might be the only Westerners around in saris, at least there were other women in London wearing similar garments. The Indian men in London, though, tended to dress like everyone else. They certainly didn't wear the white dhoti loincloth and shaved head of traditional Indian Hindu monks. The British public might have been used to seeing Muslim men in their cotton robes or women in full burqa, but I thought that a European man with a shaved head and wearing a piece of white cloth instead of pants might be another story altogether. When the three of us emerged from the bathroom with our shaved heads, but for the small tuft at the crown left by Vaishnava priests, we were greeted with cheers. I was attached to my hair and felt self-conscious, but Janaki gazed fondly at my bald white head. "You look beautiful," she said, and I immediately felt better. The next day, I embarked on my first journey as a full-fledged out-in-the-open devotee. I was on my way to the arts lab in my dhoti, yellow turtleneck sweater, shaved head, and blazing white tilak mark on my forehead, indicating for anyone who cared to look that my body was a temple of God. As it turned out, a great many people looked. I was followed by stares as I walked to the bus stop, and a few people made double takes. I boarded the bus and made my way to the upper level, with the eyes of all passengers on me. Most were too polite to stare, but they sneaked looks at me from behind their tabloids. My head was cold. I felt like I was performing an act of surrender mixed with a hint of exhibitionism. Drury Lane turned out to be situated in the center of the London entertainment scene. The arts lab was run by a couple of American guys called Jim Haynes and Jack Moore, and it was neighbored by lots of theaters and opera houses. I intrigued Jack and Jim by the way I looked, and they quickly agreed to allow us to hold programs in the arts lab. The lab wasn't exactly a community because no one lived there, but it nevertheless served as a central gathering place for increasingly large numbers of young Londoners interested in peace, justice, vegetarianism, and left-wing political activities. The arts lab functioned as a center of music making, as an art gallery, as a venue for the screening of alternative films. Occasionally, the lab allowed blue filmmakers to shoot nudie films. Fence sitters would be enticed to strip off for the shoot with 10-pound notes, or a bit more if they were prepared to do other things. Later that week, the six of us piled into the 1935 Ford Poplar pickup Shyamasundar had purchased for next to nothing. Its cab held only two people, him and Malati, plus their baby Saraswati, so the rest of us sat cross-legged in the back on the truck's wooden floor. During a torrential downpour a few days later, I had erected a wooden frame around the rear tray of the truck, over which I hung an olive-green tarpaulin. The covering hung down on the sides so as to protect us from the elements, but it had the effect of concentrating London's omnipresent diesel fumes. I could see that we were going to have to get used to the smell of diesel if we were going to continue traveling like this. Fortunately, it was a short ride to the arts lab. The place was full of people milling around the front counter and reading the large bulletin board that held announcements of gigs, gatherings, and other events in the city. Someone was selling pottery. Someone else was giving a demonstration of some kind of New Age therapy. There was a bookstall where people talked together and passed joints around. The air smelled musty, like cigarette smoke, incense, pot, and feet. The patrons looked pretty much like the alternatives in San Francisco, and they loved the chanting, even if they seemed a bit more reserved than their American brothers and sisters. On our first night there, Jim and Jack let us chant in the main hall, which was about half the size of a basketball court. There were lots of happy faces and people singing along that night, and several even took off their shoes and danced on the carpeted floor. Our arts lab program became a regular thing, our primary venue through which to get in touch with the British people. 3 times a week, we drove into the city and chanted with about 100 people. After the first couple of weeks, the novelty of the program wore off, and Jim and Jack relegated us to the smaller room upstairs, which was painted all black and was used as the lab's theater. It was always covered in cigarette butts that we had to sweep up before each chanting session. And there's a photo of us chanting in that theater. We wrote to the Swami to inform him about our programs, hoping that he would respond positively. We knew our primary objective in London was to open a temple, but we were quickly realizing that things were different here than in America. The Swami responded promptly to our letters, and when each letter arrived, the person to whom it was addressed read it aloud for everyone to hear. "This is giving me so much pleasure to hear how nicely you are carrying on this movement in London," Malati read out in September. "It was originally my Guru Maharaj's desire that there should be a center established in London. And by his mercy, now you have successfully begun this mission. So please keep me informed how you are progressing there. I am very anxious to hear in each letter. You all three couples are expert in the matter of preaching Krishna consciousness. So I am sure by your combined effort in London, there will be a great successful center." The matter of the center was always on our minds, but getting one started was a question of money and contacts. The Swami wrote with some practical suggestions about how we could increase both. "Why don't you get back to Godhead from New York?" he suggested. "Here in New York, they are selling an average of 100 copies of Back to Godhead each day. So try to get immediately copies from New York and try to sell them in large quantities. This is our backbone. Kirtan plus distribution of our books and literature is the basic principle of our success." Here was a confirmation from the Swami about how to spread Krishna consciousness, about how to spread his movement in London. Distribution of spiritual literature and public chanting. And so it came to pass, one cold and overcast morning, that the six of us in Saraswati donned our best Vaishnava clothing, piled into the Ford pickup, and headed out to have our first chant in the streets of London. We decided to try Trafalgar Square first. It was always packed with tourists, and we thought that the statue of Lord Nelson atop his 100-foot perch would be a fitting witness to our first public chanting foray in London. We parked the truck and filed onto the square, cold and nervous but exhilarated, our colorful clothing a stark contrast to the gray of the square. I started to play our only mridanga while the others played their kartals. The pigeons strutting about scavenging for crumbs took flight instantly at the sound of our cymbals. Our voices and instruments resounded around the sprawling cement plaza, attracting an immediate response. A crowd of tourists, shoppers, and business people began to form around us. Some tapped their feet and smiled, but most stood statuesque in disbelief. To muster up courage, I pretended the Swami was there in the crowd watching us. Cars, lorries, taxis, and bright red buses careened past us on four sides, and the square's fountains spewed water. But to anyone close enough, our chanting drowned out every other sound. The traffic, the warbling of the birds, and the spray of water cascading into the pools that surrounded the fountains. Nelson must be getting bored up there sometimes, I thought, as we began to sway in synchrony. This will liven up his day. Gazing up at the larger-than-life statue of the Admiral, standing regally on top of his column, I felt my apprehensions scatter, like the flock of pigeons had a few minutes earlier. That is, until I started to notice the startled eyes of the uniformed police, who had begun to gather on the periphery of the crowd. I thought maybe I was being paranoid, but there did seem to be an awful lot of them, maybe 30 or more. They formed a little clutch about 10 yards from the crowd. They huddled together and kept glancing back at us as if developing some sort of strategy. "Surely they can't arrest us," I thought. "We have Saraswati with us. And anyway, we're not doing anything wrong. We're just enjoying ourselves and giving the lunchtime crowd some entertainment. And I don't see how they can think there's anything wrong with that. On the other hand, they might think we've been taking drugs or that we're carrying acid." The crowd had grown to nearly 100. And I realized that we should have made a leaflet to explain what we were doing. I kept chanting, pounding my mridanga. Finally, one of the bobbies emerged from their conference. He strode purposely toward the center of the crowd and waited until I wasn't singing, and the other five were responding to my lead. I tried to appear calm, but inside I felt shivery and my heart was thumping. Panic was setting in. My traumatic encounter with the police in Hurleyville was still fresh in my memory. "May I speak with your leader, please?" He pitched his words carefully, his voice authoritative and loud. I relaxed immediately. "He's gently inquisitive," I thought. "How quaint." I'd expected an American response. "You guys got to get out of here right now. Or worse, we're going to search your bags." I kept playing my mridanga, but a bit softer. I felt the crowd close in ever so slightly, their eyes sparkling with curiosity. A derelict carrying a big black sack staggered a few feet in front of us, and the policeman was momentarily distracted. You can speak with me if you like, I said, over the sound of my mridanga. Right, he said. I'm afraid I have to inform you that it is illegal to play instruments that are musical in this square. What about singing? Not in a group, I'm afraid. He sounded so regretful. Where were the handcuffs and the attitude? That's illegal too? I'm afraid so. There may be other parks where you can sing with instruments. Maybe you should try somewhere else. Guru Das heard the whole conversation and informed the others. The policeman continued to stand next to me, akimbo, his colleagues watching from a distance. We kept chanting, but conferred together and decided we'd better go somewhere else rather than risk getting arrested. The policeman's stare was turning into a glare, so I brought the chanting to a close. The crowd immediately dispersed. Okay, we're going to leave then, I said. We don't want to cause any trouble. Righto, he said, and sauntered away. The mist was thickening as we hurried back to the pickup, more than a little disappointed in our less than sterling start. The fog was turning into a drizzle. Maybe we should just go home, Malati said. The weather is depressing and we're all cold. I think we should try one more place, Guru Das said. The Swami wants us to do public chanting, and how are we going to do that if we don't get us to a place out in public? Well, we could wait for a brighter day, I said. I think we'll be doing a lot of waiting then, Shyamasundar said. This is London, not California. We've got months of this ahead of us. We all looked downcast at these words. You know, he said, the nice thing about all this is that we're really not doing anything. We're just instruments in Krishna's hands. We trudged along silently, absorbing the words. You're right, you know. That's right, Janaki said, flicking a raindrop from the end of her nose. We're always thinking it's us who are making things happen or not happen. But really, it's Krishna. That can make you feel kind of distant from the world, though, I said. You know, if you feel like you're not the one who's making stuff happen in your life. That's only because it's bruising to the ego, Shyamasundar said. We always want to be the one who's controlling everything, but we're not. Krishna has brought us here, and it's in his hands if we succeed or not. Well, sure, I said sarcastically. We just sit back and wait for Krishna to do it for us. I was wet, and the wind was freezing. No, we still have to try, Guru Das said. I read this story about the bird in the Swami's books. She laid her eggs on the beach, and the waves washed them out to sea. When she asked the ocean to return them, the ocean refused. So she decided to dry up the ocean by scooping up the water with her beak. Then Garuda, the bird king, hears about her determination, you know, and he threatens to dry up the whole ocean. So then the ocean gets scared and gives back the little bird's eggs. So I guess the moral is, if we're determined, then we get reciprocation from Krishna. I thought about what they were saying. Before we came to England, I had become particularly enamored with myself. The way I did things, the way I thought, the way I looked, the way I succeeded, the way I appeared socially with an attractive wife, the way I convinced people to do some service for Krishna, the way I organized events, the way I got publicity for the movement, even the way I walked, I was basking in the feeling that I was making things happen, not the Swami, not Krishna, but me. I'll have to continue to contemplate this concept of who is behind everything, I thought. In a way, it would be a great relief to be able to see myself as an instrument in a greater plan, as a small part of a great undertaking led by the Swami, who was its architect. Okay, I said, let's look for one more place and then we'll call it a day. We drove west for about 15 minutes through the agonizingly slow and reeking London traffic. We spotted a little place called Soho Square, a much smaller area than Trafalgar Square, enclosed by a black wrought iron gate and covered with sodden grass and a few small paved walkways. In the center was a tiny wooden gazebo, a Georgian-style shelter that was big enough for about four people to stand underneath. The rain was now thundering down, and the square was deserted, as empty as a raided cookie jar. The Swami would be proud of us, I thought to myself as we parked the truck. He would want us to be determined, and continuing to chant in this weather really shows that we are. We hurried into the square, the rain stinging our faces as we ran. No police in sight. No one at all in sight, actually. Still, I thought, this is our London debut, and we are the Swami's spiritual warriors. A little bit of rain can't dampen our spirits, even if we are getting soaked to the skin. We started chanting again and noticed a few brave souls zipping through the small park, their umbrellas shielding them from the curtains of water that swept over the square. I felt my determination drowning, my enthusiasm from 10 minutes earlier being swept away with the torrent flowing from the subterranean pipes through the street gratings. Who would be mad enough to stop and listen to a band of chanters like us in this weather? Then I saw that one person had stopped. He was a middle-aged man in foggy round eyeglasses with a wet newspaper folded neatly under his arm. He was fastidiously dressed in a blue overcoat and bowler hat and was holding a small leather briefcase with his belt clips. The rain drummed on his umbrella, but he seemed oblivious to the weather. His head was tilted in curiosity. This wasn't some fickle tourist, I thought. He's a true blue Brit, a member of the establishment. We chatted for 5 minutes more and then decided that staying out any longer might give the baby pneumonia and damage the drum. As we started to make our way across the square, our sole spectator came toward us. "What's it in aid of?" he asked. Because of the unfamiliar intonation of his British accent, I had to ask him to repeat his question twice. "This is the same singing that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did in the 16th century in India," I explained, once I'd figured out what he was asking. I hoped I was sounding authoritative to this English gentleman. "We're his followers, so we're doing the same thing." He was listening intently. Rivulets of water flowed off my bare head and into my eyes. He tipped his umbrella toward me and moved even closer so that I was sheltered from the deluge. "The mantra you heard us singing was sung in public every day in West Bengal, and it's still sung in many parts of India today. The philosophy is based on the Bhagavad Gita. Have you heard of that?" "Yes, certainly I have," he said. When he spoke, his trimmed brown mustache moved in time with his words. "The Gita was first written in Sanskrit 5,000 years ago," I said. "It's a very old system of chanting. So what you heard is something very ancient," he nodded. "What is the location of your school in London?" he asked. "We don't have one yet," I said. "We want to start a center, but we haven't found a place yet." I was delighted that someone so conservative-looking would have such genuine interest. I glanced at the others who were walking away toward the truck. "I think we're going to have to go now," I said. "It's really wet." "Thank you very much for your time," he said politely. He tipped his hat at me and waved to the others. "Good luck," he shouted as I walked away. "Keep an eye out for us," I called, "because we'll be back." I couldn't possibly have known then, in 1968, that those words of mine would prove prophetic. Not only would our chanting parties be established as a daily event in London within a year, but less than 100 feet from us, in Soho Square, lay the building that would become an ISKCON center in 1978, the permanent inner-city temple of the Hare Krishna movement in London.